I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. The case that I'm going to cover today is that of the murder of Ryan O'Connor. And it is a really difficult listen as ever. And as I always say at the very beginning of these, you know, I'm very aware that there is a family connected to the loss of this young man. And it's just tragic that we're even covering this case. 19-year-old Louis Aquilina and 19-year-old Elliot Vettini's lives literally revolved around stealing cars, otherwise known as TWOC, taking without owner's consent. It's what they spent their free time, pretty much meaning all their time, as they weren't exactly pro-social individuals going to the office at 8 o'clock and coming home at 5:30 every day. That wasn't their style. They basically would travel to pre-selected locations. Aquilina would look out, make sure that the area was clear so they could get away with the theft. Vettini would smash the window. Then they would plug the machine that programmed the key fob, because can you believe that those things exist? There you are, buying a car, thinking, this is going to be secure, surely, because I have my own key fob, which means that nobody's going to be able to steal it because there isn't a key anymore. You're wrong. You can probably pick them up on eBay. That's how easy it is, which makes all of that money invested in new technology, I don't know, smart a little. They would then switch the plates and then they sold the cars on. I wouldn't say it was a highly sophisticated outfit, but certainly the fact that they could do that shows that there is, shall we say, a desire for stolen cars consistently. And they would then split the money 50-50. They had their own, shall we say, criminal entrepreneurship, even though they weren't the brightest tools in the kit. The point is, they had found a way to make money, and they'd found a way to make money fast. Surprisingly, Aquilina actually didn't have any previous convictions until he gets accused of this case. Although, when you do look at his haircut, one could argue it is a criminal offence in itself. But I've checked, and the courts are not yet accepting such potential convictions. I'm not saying that shouldn't be the case. I'm saying sadly it isn't the case, because he would have received life if that were the case. But when he gets arrested for this, he does admit that he had taken around a dozen cars at this point. He was also known to possess knives, and there was definitely evidence of his violent nature, because he'd been known to smack his girlfriend in the mouth. He'd also attacked another girl's father. Also, he made a video assaulting a young man that he accused of being a snitch. I have issues with that. Not just the fact that clearly it says something reprehensible about the nature of an individual that feels entitled to attack a young boy because of the fact that he is apparently a snitch, but then to record that and share it, meaning essentially that you are now the snitch on the kid who's been a snitch. It doesn't make sense to me. You know what I mean? Go with me on it. The kid was apparently a snitch about somebody else. So this guy doesn't just let everyone know that that kid's a snitch, snitching on the snitch. He then videos the fact that he's snitched on the snitch and passes that around, meaning that possibly other people could snitch on him being a snitch on other people being a snitch. Throwing it out there. Vettini had a criminal history though. So the co-defendant here at this moment that we're talking about, he did have a relatively hefty criminal history, including 27th of August 2019, he actually steals an Amazon delivery van. Now, of course, this is Amazon. Amazon probably have trackers in the people that work for Amazon, but they definitely, by the way, they probably don't. I'm just being sarcastic before anyone from Amazon is like, Emma Kenny is accusing all staff of having physical trackers in them. I know you don't. I also do use Amazon a great deal, so don't start avoiding my home. I require your services. But deliveries that happen with Amazon always have trackers. So the vans obviously are always aware of where they are because of the fact that they need to make sure that these kind of things don't happen, that they don't get robbed. So this means that ultimately, whilst he's driving the Amazon van, the police are called and they end up in a police chase. He then ditches the vehicle and hides from the officers. Probably better just to run. I mean, just hiding somewhere doesn't mean they'll be like, oh, this guy's really good. We've been searching for like over 30 minutes. I say that we just all go home. Clearly not. They'll just get the police dogs, etc. Anyway, when they find him, it turns out he had no license and he was disqualified from driving at the time. So it says something about his consequential thinking process. This is an individual who's already not allowed to be on the roads and does something as bodacious as stealing an Amazon van. So he's not caring or careful about consequences. 2 months after that offence, he steals £480 worth of alcohol from a Tesco store. And that in itself is an enormous amount of alcohol. And I'm not sure how anybody would believe they would be able to get away with it. But nonetheless, that's what he did. The offence was also committed in breach of a suspended sentence order, which does not go down well for you. If you have a suspended sentence, you have to behave absolutely impeccably. If you fail to behave impeccably, it can become a sentence that you have to serve in prison. It's been suspended so that you can prove to the world around you that you are behaving. But this individual, again, no consequential thinking. Also, previously, he'd been charged and convicted of assaulting his girlfriend, assault by beating, having a bladed article in a public place, aggravated vehicle taking, causing vehicle damage, driving whilst disqualified, and driving dangerously. Also had a previous conviction for robbery. Basically, he was a driver in the car that a man was bundled into, threatened, and robbed. In another incident, during a school trip, he smashed a milk bottle and used it to stab another pupil in the face. At that point, got charged with inflicting a grievous bodily harm. In spite of all of those horrific incidents, predominantly it was noted that his record evidenced that he was a car thief and a joyrider. But a little bit of insight into that particular defendant. Not exactly the kind of child one would be proud of, not exactly the kind of scenario where society feels safe believing that individuals like that are walking down the street or driving on our roads. Also, I always take aim at the word joyrider. I appreciate that comes from the position that the individual who is stealing the car or being a passenger in a car seems to get some kind of a rush of happiness from the experience. But the consequences of joyriding are horrifying. Pedestrians get killed, other motorists get killed, cyclists get killed. There are a whole heap of social issues associated with people stealing cars and driving at speed, particularly when there are police chases. I found it really challenging at times to watch footage where joyriders, in inverted commas, are being chased by the police. You can just see the carnage that will be created if they crash. And it's not just the people who are innocent bypassers who can be impacted. You know, joyriders' lives, when they come to an end, also impact on their families and so on and so forth. So it is a really horrible activity that certain individuals feel they are given some kind of rush from, but actually, in my opinion, shows that they have very low self-esteem, because if you have no value for yourself, well, you'll put yourself in positions of great danger. In the early hours of 10th of June 2021, Fatini and Aquilina steal several cars. This is in and around the Cardiff area. The pair haven't actually been great friends for a long time. It's only been a few months that they've got on. And during this period, as a bonding exercise, because we're like that with friends, aren't we? We're like, what have we got in common? Oh, I like reading in the cinema. I too like reading in the cinema. Shall we join a book club together and, I don't know, take a mobile phone contract that allows us to have cinema tickets 2 for 1 on a Tuesday evening? Shall we do that? It's a great idea. That's a healthy bonding exercise for friends, but not for these friends. These friends are like, what are your interests? More like robbing cars or just like racing them around and causing dangerous driving and putting lives at risk? No way, bruv. we should definitely do that together. It's something like that, and I didn't do it in a Welsh accent because I don't know how to. It's as simple as that. But for them, this kind of relationship was a way of life. You know, it was connecting with people who did similar things to you that also benefited you financially. They would steal cars, they would sell cars, and that was something that worked for them. One of the cars stolen that night was a blue Fiesta, and that blue Fiesta had cloned plates. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's when there is a legitimate car on the road and the plates of that car essentially is cloned to another car. So if the police happen to check, it will come up, hopefully, that the car is insured, because they are hot on stopping cars and pulling them over if the car is obviously not insured. So you can get away with it by not notifying the police that there is a problem with that car. That Fiesta had been stolen from Risket and Caerphilly around 12:45 a.m. The pair eventually returned back to Cardiff around 5 a.m. At this point, they had sadly, for them, been unable to sell the Fiesta. And this is why they were able to use it as transport later that day to pick up 18-year-old Ethan Strickland. That was from his home in Ely. It was around 8 p.m. And Strickland, well, he was accompanied by two other youths. That was 17-year-old Joseph Jeremy and 17-year-old Kyle Racis. That's Saquilina's cousin. Now, they together had several previous convictions for possession of knives, which is worrying. We don't want young people wandering around with knives. Young people, even the best and the most pro-social of young people, don't have the same level of consequential thinking as you do when you're 40. It's a generational thing. It's a growing up thing. It's a maturing thing. It happens as we get older, at least on the whole. So you don't want any young person really having a connection with knives, because everybody has a bad day, for example. So they'd all been at Strickland's home photographing each other, and no, it wasn't nice selfies, arms around each other, you know, for the memories. It was them all holding large knives. Let me take a picture of me with a big knife so that we have evidence that we're the kind of people who associate with big knives. Not forensically sophisticated, but indicative of their mindsets. So now the group are together. They drive from Ely towards Newport. A little bit of trivia. I once dated a man from Newport. Well, he's a very young man because I was young. I used to work in Swansea and I was involved with a hunt saboteur group from Newport, Cardiff, Swansea, and quite a few other areas. We'd all meet and then we'd go and wreck the fox hunt. Sorry if you liked fox hunting. I'm just avidly against it. So I was one of those people who would, you know, disrupt it. And that's my experience of Newport. Nice people. Anyway, we're not talking about nice people right now, are we? So Aquilina at this point is driving. Fatina's in the front passenger seat. Jeremy, Racis and Strickland are in the back. And this is how they are travelling at this moment in time. And the group literally have one thing on their mind. One thing. Trouble. They had decided that they wanted to find somebody and they wanted to stab them and they wanted to rob them. And I'm saying that as it's playing out. That is literally the decision that they have made. Apart from the fact that they've been stealing cars, apart from the fact that their sorry asses were not exactly individuals who were a benefit to our society anyway, the intention that they all have together is harrowing. The idea that they had got in that car with a desire to go out and brutalise an individual is harrowing. Also, this isn't something they're just saying. They've come prepared. So Jeremy, Racis and Strickland, they're all armed. And they're not armed with, you know, little weapons. Not that any little weapon cannot be highly dangerous. People can be murdered with a flick knife, a pen knife, a screwdriver. Of course they can. But these young men had large hunting knives. Large hunting knives. The kind you see in horror movies. Four of the youths also had balaclavas and gloves. So they wanted to disguise themselves. But also, balaclavas and gloves clearly serve a purpose in the fact that you can't tell the person behind that because you can't see their face. But it's also the message it gives. it's terrifying to see somebody in a balaclava and gloves. It says something ultimately about what that person's intention is. Fettini didn't have a balaclava on. He wore a blue COVID face mask. So again, it would have been very difficult to identify them if you didn't know who they were. They were a really violent gang. And they were the kind of violent gang that were really proud of their activities. And unfortunately, whilst they may have been proud of their activities and they may have thought that they were very, very hard, you know, because we get this, don't we? We get the boys and even the girls who think that it's cool to be hard. If you don't know what hard is and you're coming from a different country, it's a colloquialism used for tough, by the way. I often think I use these colloquialisms like bang to rights, which is one of my favourite statements and sayings, which basically means you're caught red-handed. And then I think, do people really know what I'm on about sometimes? So as describing there, hard means you think you're tough. Simple as that. And they would go on social media to boast about their exploits. They'd show off their weapons. They'd talk about their violent encounters, the activities they got up to. You know, for example, if you're the CPS and you're trying to weigh up whether these individuals, the case you have to look at whether it's worth answering, are individuals who have basically posted their criminality all over social media in chronological order. Good job there, boys. Really bright. Jeremy, while still legally a minor, actually already had a criminal record. He was wanted by the police. He removed an electronic tag, which was part of his sentence for a really serious knife crime that he committed a few months earlier. He'd literally attacked a young man called Sammy Osborne in Cardiff. And after he'd carried out that really brutal knife attack, he'd boasted about it on social media. Now, because he was clearly not considered an adult, he didn't get the same kind of level of sentence that you would expect an adult to get. It was more lenient. He was sentenced to 15-month youth rehabilitation order. Part of that youth rehabilitation order was a requirement of his tagging, and that requirement was to stay out of Cardiff. They didn't want him in Cardiff. That's why you wear a tag. It can firstly alert the police to where you are and whether you're abiding by the rules and regulations given to you by that tag. And secondly, it can offer some protection to individuals that might have been victims, because clearly if you have to stay away from the area that victim lives in, it gives them a level of security. Now, cutting that tag off, obviously it's a breach of his sentencing terms. Also, he had been convicted previously for racially aggravated assault and possession of an imitation firearm. He's still not an adult, and he's literally got that record. I mean, it's horrific. It's high level. It's consistent. And certainly, it's involving weapons. That's genuinely a cooking pot of possibility as far as problems are concerned. Now, Jeremy, like the rest of the group, well, also obsessed with knives, and apparently had been obsessed with knives from a really young age. Loads of pictures of him on social media posing with knives. Also worth noting, he had involved with CAMHS, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. That was from quite a young age. And from what I have read about him and what I understand, having read this about him, is that he'd always been an outsider. He was an individual who had struggled to what we consider form close relationships, meaningful relationships. He also had a diagnosis of ADHD and ASD. He had issues with impulsive aggression. He had a violent reputation. And in spite of the fact that he felt he was a real outsider and certainly didn't have these kind of connections that would have been positive for him, there was certainly a desire within him to be considered a gangster. He liked people to look at him and be fearful. But it would be remiss of me to not note that lots of young people want to be seen as a contender in life. You know, some kids are lucky. they get to be top of the class and everything. Some kids are just sports stars. Some kids are in a subculture where, you know, they're considered a bit kooky and quirky by others, but in their subculture, they're considered really unique and interesting. There are places and pieces of the puzzle in adolescence that make us believe that we have a level of belonging during a really confusing time. Anybody watching my videos will know that sometimes I think that adolescence should be banned entirely. We should just be placed in a coma until we're like 25 and fed with lots of meditation and interesting facts about the world so that we can wake up having transversed difficult periods and emerge very knowledgeable and calm. But apparently that would not be acceptable on any way level clinically. It is interesting for me to talk about the fact that he fits that criteria just purely because clearly we're dealing with somebody with mental health issues and with some impulse regulation issues that would make life more difficult, but that gives him absolutely no excuse as far as I'm concerned for what we're going to talk about today. There was also evidence of him struggling with suicidal ideation, which is a way of saying that he contemplated and fantasized to some degree and felt fixated with the idea of ending his life. Now, his parents had actually split when he was young. He began living with his father in 2020. However, literally a week before the crime that we're going to talk about, he'd moved in with Strickland. Not ideal when you think about the background of the characters that I'm talking about today. He left school at 14 and he attended a pupil referral unit. I used to run a pupil referral unit. So a pupil referral unit is a place to go if you're a child who has struggled at school. Often it involves being excluded permanently from school and you are sent to complete your education at a more specialist unit. However, this also means that you are often surrounded by other young people who have lots of issues. And as opposed to that curtailing some of the problems that these young people are enduring, it can add to them. Got to be honest with you. It's like anything. If you place a child with lots of needs, with other children with lots of needs, then you have a greater possibility of those needs amplifying. That noted, it's really important for kids to be given an education. If you're excluded from school, you need somewhere to go. Now, it's also worth noting that he had been friends with a drug dealer who was also a teenager called Brandon Diamond, aka Brandon Liversidge, which was his real name. I don't know why Brandon felt that Brandon Diamond was a better name for a gangster than Brandon Liversidge. I personally think Brandon Diamond would have been a better drag stage name, throwing it out there. But obviously he had felt it made him sound street. Anyway, he gets convicted of murdering a man called Harry Baker. This is in Barry in Wales. He stabs him to death. It's a turf war issue. And he got sentenced to life imprisonment just last year, in fact. Now, Jeremy has a fascination also with knives. And he actually managed to use his father's driving license to buy knives online because you've got to be over 18. He started ordering knives when he was 15 years of age, and they included Predator, Rambo, and zombie knives, which are all utterly horrific to look at and terrifying. And to imagine the kind of damage those knives would do to a human body, well, it's unimaginable. So just days before the crime that we're going to talk about today, he'd actually brought two 15-inch Anglo hunting knives. That was for himself and racists. They were the weapons that they were actually armed with the day that this horrific crime plays out. And clearly, when you are driving around with those on you as a person, it says something very dark about the possibilities that can eventuate. Now, let's talk about our victim. So whilst this is all going on, whilst this carload of, I'm going to use the word my mother would use, yobs, or you could say thugs, or I don't know, you could call them a swear word. But basically, this group of social reprobates are in a car together, armed up, and with balaclavas and so on and so forth. We have, in a complete different universe, 26-year-old Ryan O'Connor. He was spending lots of quality time that day with his family. Now, Ryan was actually known quite well. He was from Alway in Newport, and he was known by his friends really affectionately with the nickname Apple. He was described by his family as a really pleasant, happy-go-lucky character. He'd do anything for anyone. He was known to be social, he was known to be outgoing, but he was popular. He was one of those people that people knew, and not for any negative reason. They knew him because he was a really cheery soul. He was really easy to communicate with. He was a nice guy. So because of that, he stood out. And also, it's worth noting at this point that life was really good for Ryan at this time. He'd just become a dad. He had a little boy called Teddy. Teddy was soon to have his first birthday. And Ryan was one of those dads, you know, the really proud father. I know a lot of you will relate to this. When he had scans of his son done with his partner, he went around showing everybody. He was really excited. He'd always wanted a son. He also was in a position where he was thriving. He was just about to start a new job the following week. He'd just got his construction skills certificate, which meant that he could go and work on a local site. He was genuinely on the up and up, both on a family level, but also professionally, socially, familially, and environmentally. It was all going really well for Ryan. On the 10th of June, 2021, so around 7:30 PM, Ryan goes and visits his brother, that's Daniel O'Connor, and his sister-in-law, Lauren Flood. They're having a family meal. Again, this is a really connected family. They all get on really, really well. And that speaks volumes to me. It really does. When you have siblings who, as young adults, want to still hang out with each other, want to have fun with each other, want to eat with each other. Also, that particular day, he was super excited because he'd bought a new bag, and it was something that had cost a considerable amount of money. He'd saved up for it. It was a black Gucci bag, and it had a silver badge with Gucci on it. So it was easy to see that it was a quality item. And when he brought it round, he actually asked his sister to smell it. She said that he wanted her to see whether she could smell it was real leather. And it was empty, but inside it did have two 20 notes, so it hadn't got cards in and so on and so forth. Now, he was so proud of that bag, but under no circumstances whatsoever could he have ever imagined just how much that bag would cost him. So he leaves his brother and sister-in-law's around 8:45 PM, and he says that he's going to go and see a friend and that he'll see them tomorrow. Again, evidence of a very close family. He walks in the direction of Aberthaw Road. That saying goodbye, when he tells them he's going to go and see a mate, that would be the last time they would ever see Ryan alive. It's hard to even conceive how a family would feel knowing that that just everyday, ordinary situation, a meal, chat, having some fun, catching up on news, and saying goodbye would be the last words that you ever shared. I only think that that's one of the most challenging things about loss, isn't it? I mean, there's so much that we want to say to people that we love. There's so much meaning that they have in our world. And you never know when that last opportunity to let that person know how much they mean will be. It's kind of why I always believe that every single time we say goodbye to people that we love, we should just let them know, so that you're always aware that you've closed the door on that sense that they were completely, absolutely, and without any shadow of a doubt, aware of your feelings towards them. 5 minutes before Ryan leaves that particular address, this is about 8:40 PM, Lewis Pritchard's been riding his bike, and Lewis Pritchard is just gutting about his business, but he spots this blue Fiesta and he notices that there's a police car driving behind it. He then sees that Fiesta turn into Aberthaw Road. Now, as the car passed Lewis, the driver slowed down and pulled down his balaclava. That really struck Lewis. And he kind of notices this car and thinks, now, there's something wrong there. He can see straight away that the occupants of that car are up to absolutely no good. And in that moment, he actually thought, my God, they're going to come and attack me. But the car doesn't. It carries on driving towards the roundabout on Balfe Road. It's at this point that the vehicle's occupants identify their unfortunate victim. They see this young man and he's walking alone and he's carrying a black Gucci bag. So instantly, he becomes the target. Ryan, all the while, he's just walking along the pavement on Balfe Road. He's just going towards his friend's house to spend an evening. Lewis, who had seen and been concerned by the blue Fiesta, who had kind of kept an eye on what was playing out because he knew that there was something not right, he witnesses the horror that happens next, moment by moment. The blue Fiesta comes to a sudden stop. It's driven by Aquilina. Aquilina gets out of the vehicle. He's dressed all in black, balaclava pulled down over his face. And he sees that Aquilina is literally armed with a foot-long machete. And that machete had actually been handed to him by his cousin, Racis. He runs towards Ryan, shouting, "Oi, come here." Now, what would you do? You see a guy, a balaclava. He's got a knife with him, a big knife with him. Well, Ryan sees this guy approaching him and he just tries to escape and he starts to run. And he runs. He runs over the roundabout. But he trips. He falls on the grass centre. Aquilina catches up to him. Remember, Ryan is completely defenceless. He's just lay on the ground. There is nothing that he can do. He's not armed. This is completely out of the blue. He's in shock. Aquilina brings the machete down on him. And Ryan's trying to defend himself. He's actually stabbed through his right hand, just trying to protect himself. And Aquilina just continues to attack him. He's determined to steal the Gucci bag. But it's more than that, isn't it? Because you know what? If you want to steal a Gucci bag, you just say to a helpless, defenseless man who's on the floor, "Give me your bag." You threaten him with your knife. The man gives you the bag. No one's going to risk their life for a bag. But that isn't the end of this attack, no. Because meanwhile, Jeremy, who's also dressed in black, he's wearing a balaclava, he's armed with a hunting knife. He's exited the vehicle as well, just after Aquilina. He runs up to the injured Ryan, and then he starts. And he delivers multiple horrific blows with this 15-inch blade. One of those blows hits Ryan's chest, another into his back, and it far exceeds any idea of the force necessary to steal that bag from Ryan. So obvious. Jeremy wanted his victim dead. Simple as that. In fact, I think both of them at that point wanted Ryan dead. The Gucci bag is the ruse for the robbery. It's not the reason. Jeremy then runs, as any coward would, back to the waiting car, as does Aquilina, but not before kicking Ryan, who's already critically injured on the floor. Yeah, just kicks him to literally add insult to injury. They then pass the stolen bag to Racis. Now, at this point, Fatini is in the driving seat because obviously they want to make a quick getaway. So they speed off and Ryan, at this point, somehow, probably due to the adrenaline, manages to stand up and he staggers a few yards, but then he just collapses against the railings. And at this point, passers-by are just running up to help him. And Fatini, who's driving, well, doesn't know the area well at all, so he manages to drive down a cul-de-sac. At this point, Fatini and Aquilina start arguing because obviously Aquilina's not happy that they've got to a dead end. And they change places, so Aquilina takes over the driving. They turn the car around, and they drive back the way they came. They literally drive past the crime scene. This is where Ryan is lying in a pool of blood. The members of the public are around him, and they're desperately trying to administer first aid. They are trying to save his life. As the blue Fiesta drives past them, witnesses actually hear the occupants of that car laughing and joking at the scene of the carnage. Jeremy shouting out the window, "I'm coming back for you and your boys." Bear in mind, Ryan hasn't got any boys. Brian's just an innocent father, a pro-social human being loved by his family. He is not a gang member. And it's just, again, the sense that you get that this group of thugs are just playing out a sick fantasy. None of it's based in reality. Ryan's just an innocent victim, a bypasser, just going about his business, who should have been able to go past that car without any kind of incident. And they have decided that because he's wearing a Gucci bag, it leverages them an excuse to attack. And even once they've done it, they think it's funny to just stop the car to try to humiliate him further. Whilst this is all playing out, a short distance away, Ryan's sister-in-law's basically on her balcony having a cigarette. And suddenly she hears a guy shouting up to her that Apple, which we know is Ryan's nickname, has been stabbed. And this guy says, get his brother. Daniel at this point is in the shower, and Daniel gets dressed quickly, gets outside, runs to the roundabout where obviously all the people have gathered. By the time that Daniel arrives, he can see that a member of the public's performing cardiac massage on Ryan. The hood of Ryan's top was literally full of blood. Also, when Daniel looks at his brother, it's clear that Ryan's been sick. There's vomit all over his face. Daniel doesn't know what to do, so he just holds his brother's hand. He notices straight away that his brother's hand is bleeding severely because of the defense wounds. So then he tries to apply pressure to the chest wound, but blood just keeps pouring out. PC Bianca Robson is the first emergency responder on the scene, and when she arrives, she can see that there is a woman who's just trying to stem the flow of blood with some towels. PC Robson immediately takes over the chest compressions, and she continues those chest compressions for 45 minutes. When the paramedics arrive, they can see that there's this large crowd of people at the roundabout, and wow, it's obvious to them straight away that Ryan isn't breathing. Paramedic applies a defibrillator on Ryan's chest, puts a ventilator on him, anything to try to save him, to bring him back to life. And when he puts that ventilator on him, it just fills with vomit. So they have to use a suction device just to clear his airways. They try everything. But ultimately, there's absolutely nothing they can do to save Ryan. The injuries are just far too severe. Ryan died in his own brother's arms. It's very hard to find any thread of peace in what I've just described, but I'm so glad that Daniel was there holding, loving, connecting with his brother in those final moments. It doesn't make it okay by any stretch, but at least he was being held in love, shall we say. Ryan gets pronounced dead at the scene at 9:30 p.m. Ryan's mum arrived at that scene a little later, and she just began screaming. She saw her dead son, and she just loses it. Of course she does. Can you imagine how you would feel in those circumstances? She would have one son covered in the blood of another. She would never have got to say goodbye to her child. All of those things stolen by those laughing thugs. When they did the autopsy on Ryan, it was horrific to find out what actually occurred. He'd suffered a total of 5 wounds in the horrific attack that took literally seconds. This included a stab wound to his upper left chest. That stab wound penetrated his left lung, and it penetrated the left ventricle of his heart. He had a stab wound to the right of his body. He had a slash or chop wound to the back of his right hand. He had a stab wound to his back that caused the left lung to collapse. Ultimately, it meant there was no chance of survival. In fact, when the autopsy was served, as far as people being able to be invited to look at what their findings were, it turned out that the chest injury alone would have proved fatal. When that blue Fiesta had passed the crime scene before, when they were mocking Ryan as he bled to death, Well, members of the public, they instantly noted down the license plate. They wanted those people caught. Simple as that. So whilst this chaos is going on, there is a savviness of those people who are spectators to this crime, and they want those people punished. They want those violent thugs brought to justice. So the police are soon on the hunt for the suspect vehicle. Meanwhile, Strickland, one of the occupants of the vehicle, have actually taken over driving the stolen Fiesta. So they've kind of shared the driving at this point. And that's important, isn't it? Because there's a level of culpability there, isn't there, where people are choosing to be driving a vehicle that has just perpetrated a very violent crime, in this case, a violent, fatal crime. 9:40 p.m., the gang stop for petrol. Yeah, I know. These guys are bright, aren't they? I mean, number one, they literally drove past the scene of the crime, wound the window down, made it clear they were the perpetrators, gave the people who were actually watching the horror unfurl enough opportunity to write down the number plate of the car. Then they go to a general petrol station, which will all be on alert that there is a stolen vehicle meeting that description, and therefore will make it easy for the police to find them. But like I said, there is nothing as stupid as the vast majority of criminals. And here we have it evidenced in this point. So anyway, the police end up in this pursuit, and it's a high-speed pursuit on the A48 because they've been alerted to know that this vehicle is around. Now, unbelievably, you would think, how are the guys in the car feeling? Well, I would imagine, yeah, full of adrenaline, of course. They would be, to some degree, excited by this because that's their criminal nature. Secondly, they may be a little bit worried. After all, they've just murdered somebody. They've got weapons in the car. They're covered in blood. And they're in a vehicle that is cloned. And some of them are already involved in the criminal justice system to a problem position that they would be returned to prison for failing to actually be in line with what they had to do for probation. If you're on a suspended sentence, you're going back to prison. So you'd imagine that those feelings would be there as well. But what you wouldn't potentially imagine is that you'd be in a scenario where you'd think, you know what I'm going to do whilst we're having this police chase? I'm going to film it. I'm literally going to film it. Thus connecting me absolutely 100% to the crime, literally. But that's what Jeremy does. Jeremy films the police chase. So bang to rights there, Jeremy, aren't we, dear? They drive through red lights. They even exceed speeds of 110 miles per hour, which is incredibly dangerous. They're overtaking vehicles. They're undertaking vehicles. It's a miracle that no one was killed, with respect. At one point, one of the gang shouts, "Don't throw the Rambos." That's in reference to the Rambo-style machetes. Now, ultimately, the police managed to deploy a stinger. A stinger is a line of very sharp metallic points, and they're there to burst the vehicle's tyres, and that's exactly what happens. And the police actually then ram the vehicle, and they ram the vehicle to a point where it actually crashes into railings. One could argue, on this occasion, it's a little bit sad. It didn't just, like the Hollywood movies, burst into a ball of flames, but it didn't. Sometimes it feels that opportunities are missed by the big G-O-D. Although arguably it could be that the big G-O-D feels that the other one, you know, the D-E-V-I-L, may have something hot and aggressive for these individuals when they take their last breaths. Just throwing it out there. But basically, that's what the police do to curtail this potential catastrophe in motion. Because bear in mind, we're talking about a serious car chase at high speed with young people in it who've carried out a heinous crime. They're probably not thinking about the future, and that could have caused an absolute amount of carnage for innocent bypassers and other drivers. The occupants at this point, knowing that they've been caught by the police, peacefully remove themselves from the vehicles, placing the weapons on the floor, put their hands on their heads, said none of my videos ever. Because now they know that they have absolutely been cornered. They just get out of the vehicle and they run. Fortunately, Aquilina and Racist are apprehended literally yards from the vehicle. Aquilina puts up a fight, resists arrest, and whilst he is struggling on the ground, he locks his arm around an officer's throat and he literally attempts to choke that officer. He's very quickly restrained, but due to the fact that he could be armed and due to the fact that he was certainly in that moment presenting a clear danger to the officer that he'd been choking, the officer struck him several times to the head. Then he managed to handcuff him. And one of the most satisfying parts of this crime, as in apprehension of it, is that Aquilina can be heard wailing whilst he's being arrested. Wailing. That's right, I'm using that word. Wailing. Such a hard guy that he is. Not nice, is it, Aquilina, when you're the one having somebody smash you around the head with their fist? And by the way, any of you thinking that's police brutality? No, it isn't. It is actually completely acceptable. And I know that the majority of you won't be thinking that anyway. But as long as it represents a force that is in line with what's being received, it is acceptable. Jeremy, at this point, as it's all playing out, he thinks, well, I'm just going to have to think about what to do next, so I will hide. So he literally just hides nearby, doesn't even properly leave the scene. And I have to say that when it comes to Jeremy, I almost feel like he's completely detached from any sense of reality because he literally live streams his arrest on social media. Yeah, he literally does that. He's already done the police chase, but now it's like the absolute ultimate. He's going to be arrested. So the officer approaches him with a taser, tells him to put the phone down, and Jeremy is like, well, I can't really put my phone down because, you know, like, I'm filming it. So then when he's advised he's being arrested on suspicion of murder, he replies, murder? And clearly he's doing that because he wants to make a point of it on film. You have to see, don't you, at this point, that Jeremy has literally no sense of who he is whatsoever, and instead is trying to make some kind of mark in the world by being known as a murdering thug. That, for him, must feel better than being an absolute nobody, which is clearly who Jeremy is in real life. So the fact that he's filming it is, yes, on one level we could say egotistical, arrogant, superior, the fact that he feels that he's entitled to do that, or we could say pathetic, needy, desperate for validation, even if that validation comes from the most heinous of scenarios. So that's how little self-esteem and self-confidence this individual actually has. Strickland, well, he throws his knife whilst he's running from the police because he doesn't want the knife associated with him on his body because that's incriminating, even though, let's be honest, the police know that they were in the car and have it on video because Jeremy was recording. And there's loads of people who can evidence that because they have social media accounts that potentially follow them. And anyway, it's recorded in the great big world of the cloud. So Strickland and Fittini, they run to the top of nearby flats. And Fittini at this point is like, oh my God, I've got my phone. I don't want my phone to be here because, you know, the police can find a whole heap of information there. So he posts it through a resident's letterbox. And that, my friends, is probably the worst disposal of a mobile phone, if you want to get away with something, than I've ever heard of. The only other would be to literally walk in to a police station and be like, excuse me, officer, I have been involved in a serious crime and I think that you'll find a lot of the information is on this phone. So you may want to, you know, have a look at the contents. Because if you post it through some resident's letterbox, that resident's not going to be like, oh my God, my postman is so kind. I have so wanted a phone like this for such a long time. You'd be like, something is not right here. I need to tell the mobile phone provider I have it, or I need to tell the police I have it. You know, it's not going to mean that you never see the phone again. Also worth noting, Strickland was crying when he was arrested and he told officers, I've only been picked up 10 minutes ago. So he's kind of instantly from the get-go trying to let the officers know that it's nothing to do with him. Fatini, at this point, says, don't say anything. And the police then tell Fatini to shut up. It's not his job to decide what Strickland says or otherwise. When the officers look in the crash fiesta, I mean, there's so much incriminating evidence. It's almost like a forensic investigator's wet dream with respect. There's two 15-inch Anglo hunting knives. One's on the rear seat, one's in the rear footwell. And when they do tests on them, well, it establishes that Ryan's blood was on both the blades. Jeremy's DNA is found on one of the handles and Grace's was found on the other. Strickland's knife is also found nearby the vehicle. So now they've kind of built this scenario where they can see that they've been traveling with a lot of weapons. Meanwhile, they find Ryan's blood on Aquilina's clothing and Grace's DNA is found on Ryan's Gucci bag. So literally bang to rights the lot of them. During the investigation, they also get the mobile phones off the people who are being considered suspects. They contain loads of damning evidence. This includes a video of Jeremy chasing a boy with a knife shouting, "I've got a knife," said no sophisticated person involved in crime ever. Also, there's loads of pictures of the gang posing with knives. So this is clearly a lifestyle that they really enjoy. Now, all five suspects are charged with Ryan's robbery and murder, and all of them plead guilty because it's just an open and shut case. They've got DNA evidence. They've got them running from the vehicle. They've live streamed the actual chase and so on and so forth. It's really easy to connect them. And that's before we even think about the DNA evidence. So, of course, they go guilty. No, they don't. No, they don't. They all plead not guilty. Not guilty. I mean, wrap your heads around all the things I've told you about this crime. Wrap your heads around that. And then think if you were the defendant's solicitor and you have, shall we say, one of the individuals whose DNA is literally on the knife that kills the victim. And they've been seen and apprehended at the car where the victim was definitely linked with death-wise. You're going to be like, you want me to say that you are innocent? And they'll be like, yeah, yeah, I definitely want you to say I'm innocent. But you were there at the scene of the crime and then you ran from the car and then you were caught basically with the knife and DNA linking you to it. I'm totally innocent. There's just been a massive mix-up. You would just be like, oh, why does the clerk give me these cases? Does the clerk in our chambers just not like me? And the answer is quite possibly if you're getting cases like this. But they all get charged. They all say they're not guilty. And this means, as we know, for the victim's family, that a trial has to take place, which is so frustrating. As we are all aware, you get reductions in sentences when you plead guilty to them, because it means that you don't have to have the cost of an ongoing court case. It means that the victim's family isn't put through hell. It means generally that the case can be dealt with more efficiently and effectively. You know, there is just a sentencing. The judge will make a decision based on the evidence given to them. I believe that if you say that you are not guilty when the evidence is clear, that when you get to a court case and are found guilty, the judge should just be able to be like, you've shown absolutely no remorse. This is a sentence that I should be able to award you for murder, but I'm going to double it. Because, you know, we halve it a lot of the time in certain situations if you are guilty of a crime and you admit to it before we ever get to a trial. And I know that you don't get that with murder, but nonetheless, I think if you literally put a family through this, you should have your sentence doubled, simple as. That would certainly prevent some people from allowing themselves to believe that they are arrogant and entitled enough to have a case brought to the courts with this idea that somehow they're going to get off when it's clear and pertinent that they never will. The trial begins January 2022 at Newport Crown Court. In court, Fatini actually says that he's had time to reflect on what played out that day, and he states that he decided to talk to the police. He wanted to tell them what had happened. He'd had time to process the events. He knew what had happened was wrong. He said that he didn't actually know the lads in the cars had knives. He also said that Jeremy was just acting really normally in the car and that he didn't think in a million years that they were going somewhere to stab someone. He also tells police that Jeremy stabbed an innocent boy. although he said he didn't actually see him stab Ryan. So whilst he can't say, yeah, I definitely saw Jeremy go and stab this innocent boy, what he could say was, Jeremy told him that he yinged him. So clearly evidencing that he's saying, I stabbed him. Also, he was holding the knife with blood on it and laughing and joking at the time that he did that. So clearly Fatini acknowledges that this, in the moment, makes him believe that Jeremy is the individual who had actually stabbed Ryan. Now, Jeremy, on the other hand, well, he's like, right, well, I need to blame somebody as well. So he blames everything on Aquilina and Fatini. He says, look, I bought the knife in Newport, but I knew nothing about the attack. And says that basically, you know, I needed a knife for protection against this rival group in Cardiff. And he claims that he was picked on because he was small. And then he claims that he'd given his knife to Fatini after he had asked to look at it. And then says that once he'd given it to Fatini, Fatini actually hadn't given it him back. He also says that during the attack, he'd stayed in the car and said Aquilina and Fatini had attacked Ryan. Aquilina, well, he blames Jeremy for Ryan's murder, and he actually claims, mind-blowingly, that he had just tried to help Ryan during the attack. Yeah. He said that Jeremy had been completely focused on Ryan, and that he had decided that he needed to try to stop the deadly assault, and he'd actually kicked Jeremy's knee and shin, but then Jeremy had turned and raised the knife at him, so he'd run back to the car for his own safety. Now, Strickland and racist, they choose not to give evidence in their defence trial at all. But you can just see, can't you, that Jeremy and Aquilina at this moment in time, the culprits who went out and brutalised that innocent man, they're just doing the classic, you know, all for not snitching, hey chaps, all for not grassing. They're just like throwing it in each other as quickly as possible. They don't want to go down for murder, so they're just going to blame the other individual. March 2022. The trial has lasted 2 months, so just put yourself in the mindset of the family of Ryan. They have had to bear witness to this for 2 months. They've had to listen to the shocking BS that these individuals have come out with in court, trying to save their own skin. It's been 2 months. Well, the jury unanimously find Jeremy and Aquilina guilty of Ryan's robbery and murder. It's as simple as that. It's unanimous. Not one of them was questioning it. Racist is found guilty of manslaughter and robbery because he had supplied the knife used by Aquilina. So instantly culpable. Simple as that. Strickland's found guilty of robbery because he's involved in that robbery, although he wasn't involved in the actual murder itself. He was present, he knew what they were doing. And Fatini, well, Fatini is acquitted of all charges. So they find him not guilty of any of those issues. In fact, they believe the story that he tells and enters the court with, which is that he's spoken to the police, that he's reflected on what played out that day, that he had nothing to do with the actual murder. He didn't know that anyone was armed. He certainly wasn't armed, and he'd been very compliant by acknowledging the guilt of the others and by being willing to talk about that. So Fatini actually does walk free from this situation. 13th of April 2022, Judge Mr. Justice Pushpinder Saini sentenced the defendants. There were so many aggravating factors in Jeremy's case. First of all, the attack had been planned. He was armed with a knife, he was wearing a balaclava, and he was in a stolen car. The nature of the attack as well, massively aggravating. The sheer level of violence against this completely defenseless, unsuspecting, unprepared individual, it suggested that there was a clear intention to kill, and it was in a public place. Also, the murder had been for gain, because they'd stolen the Gucci bag. Further than that, there was the fact that Jeremy actually mocked his dying victim. finally, there were his previous convictions, one for a serious knife assault. So ultimately, taking into consideration, he was sentenced to life with a minimum term of 24 years for Ryan's murder, with a concurrent term of 12 years for robbery. So he's going to get a minimum of 24 years inside before essentially they look at paroling him. When it comes to Aquilina, well, the same aggravating factors applied to him, but his lack of previous convictions was taken into his account, as was the fact that he had no absolutely direct intention to kill Ryan. I mean, he died as a result of the attack, and he was certainly involved in that, and it's certainly murder, but it's not the same as Jeremy going out of his way to deliver those fatal blows. So ultimately, he gets sentenced to life with a minimum term of 22 years for Ryan's murder. He also gets a concurrent term of 12 years for robbery. When we say concurrent in the UK, it means that they're not consecutive, so they won't get 22 years and then 12 years. They look at it in totality, and essentially they decided that 22 years will be the amount of time before he's allowed to apply for parole, so to speak. So Jeremy and Aquilina are going to be age 42 when they can actually apply for parole, which I know on one level is quite a long time because they're young men, but when you think about what they did to Ryan, I don't know how safe we will feel knowing that individuals who can literally select a random innocent individual and totally decimate their bodies that way for a Gucci bag, apparently, the fact that they'll be walking our streets when they're relatively young men, they might get married and have kids. It's kind of really unfair when you think about what they've done to Ryan and his family. I mean, they've got a life sentence. It's as simple as that. You know, Ryan had a new baby. He was a year old. They've stolen a father and a future. Racers get sentenced to 12 years, that's for manslaughter, and he's given a concurrent sentence of 8 years for robbery, and that means that he'll have to serve a minimum of 2/3 of his sentence, so it's not a long time, is it? And Strickland is still awaiting sentence for robbery. It will be considered very serious, however, because of the fact that a man died during it. Vettini, interestingly, walks free from court. So it was believed that he absolutely was not involved in the killing and didn't know that it was going to play out, and certainly wasn't aware that people were armed and that he wasn't armed either. Clearly, he was also very helpful to police. This case is absolutely horrific. We're talking about a young dad just senselessly killed. And with respect, I'm going to say this in the most judgmental way ever, the tragedy is compounded by the fact that the useless waste of oxygen who pointlessly took his life will probably never possess the intelligence and emotional capacity to understand the magnitude of what they've done. They'll never even be able to connect the dots of devastation. They'll just serve their sentence and not think about the consequences of those actions. Their actions have devastated a family. They've destroyed so many lives. When I was doing my research, I found out that Ryan's family go to the roundabout every Thursday to remember him. Every single week. His brother Danny visits the cemetery for an hour before work each day, just to feel near him. He suffers flashbacks, clearly horrifically traumatized, a witness to the death of his absolutely adored brother. The family don't go out much. They say they feel safer inside. So their freedom has been curtailed by these thugs. They are suffering every day to such a degree that they do not at times leave their home because the world is no longer safe. Their victim impact statement expressed their grief and heartbreak. Ryan's son, Teddy, he's almost two. He calls out for his daddy. He's actually seen to look around for him when people enter the room hoping he's coming home. But we all know Ryan is never coming home. Ryan will never see his little boy grow up. He'll never walk into a room to be able to see the smiles and giggles of his child as he realizes he's coming home to hug him. then that's diabolical to conceive. Brian will never see that child's future, meet his girlfriend, his wife, be a grandparent. He'll never get to nurse his parents as they get old. He'll never get to do any of the things that a good man like Ryan would have done. It's offensive to my sensibilities that that's the case. You know what? He never even got to celebrate his son's first birthday. Ryan's five-year-old niece, well, she idolised him. She's now absolutely terrified that others will be taken from her. She has separation anxiety. She worries that she'll lose other relatives close to her. The ramifications of this death, of this loss, are far-reaching, still unfolding. There's a further tragedy for Ryan's family. His father, John, died during the trial. He was already suffering from ill health, but come on. It's completely unsurprising to any of us that his condition deteriorated after Ryan's death. He literally never recovered from the loss of his son. He never even got to see his son's killers brought to justice. No doubt part of the reason he died was because of a broken heart, because of the stress inflicted on him by these senseless thugs. The only slight peace I take from that is the knowledge that Ryan and his father are together now. In their statement, Ryan's family said this: "We still struggle to come to terms and ever accept the events that unfolded that evening. It still does not seem real. We expect Ryan to walk through the door of the family home, but we know that he won't. Some of us have had to do double takes when we walk past boys of a similar age and appearance in the street wearing caps like Ryan did, believing that it's him, only to know full well that it isn't. Whenever we do think about the events of that night, we struggle to appreciate why there was a need to do what they did to Ryan. The level of violence that was used against him by this group was completely unjustifiable in the circumstances. Ryan hadn't done anything to them. So why should they do that towards him?" It's heartbreaking to be able to relate to those feelings of double taking an individual that you've loved and lost. It happens to the best of us, but can you imagine in these circumstances? Because the logic of your brain when you're dealing with a young person is that they would still be present because they are young. It's hard to compute that this individual who was there and everything to you in your world has suddenly been eradicated. They've disappeared. And therefore, everything that is reminiscent of them, you see it in another human being walking down the street. You believe just for a split second that it's them. And then suddenly the harsh reality of their loss hits you again and again and again and again. Thousands of times a week sometimes. That's what Ryan's family has been left with. In the year ending March 2021, there were around 41 offences that involved a knife or a sharp instrument in England and Wales. That includes 224 homicides. So 224 people were murdered because of this. And in 19% of the cases, those crimes were carried out by 10 to 17-year-olds. 10 to 17-year-olds, 20% of the time almost, were the killers in these crimes. When we look at risk factors for kids as to why they start getting involved in knife crime, disadvantaged backgrounds, poor educational achievement, mental health issues, and also gang involvement. And we should be taking that really seriously, because more and more there are kids growing up in the UK who are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds. They're living in poverty. They're not succeeding in school. They're feeling the dysfunction in their family makes them lack a connectedness. They are going to look to belong somewhere, and gangs offer that opportunity. So if we are not going to tackle this effectively, if we're not going to acknowledge this openly, if we're not going to try to do something about this imminently, this serious issue is going to grow and grow and grow. And the problem is, as that grows, it means more young lives are going to be senselessly lost. Ryan's life was senselessly lost Teddy's father, a man who everyone loved, a man who was popular, a man who's caused such pain and loss and grief in his family that they literally remain tethered to that loss, visiting the grave daily, visiting the site where he died weekly. They live this day in and day out. And what would have prevented that happening was kids not having access to these kind of brutal instruments, and also kids being dealt with differently in a system so that they make better choices. I know it's not a perfect science. I know there'll always be individuals who fall foul of even the greatest interventions, but right now we are failing. And Ryan is a cost of that failure. The only mistake Ryan made that evening was to just leave at the wrong time. He was carrying a Gucci bag that he'd actually paid for, that his money had earned. And it is absolutely infuriating to me that these sorry-ass excuses for humans believe that they have a right to take what another person has earned. And in this case, they didn't just take the Gucci bag. They took the ultimate price, the ultimate cost. They took his life. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.